Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The last calendar case this morning is in the matter of the welfare of AM. We're prepared for arguments from appellant's counsel. Could appellant's counsel please introduce himself for the record and then present argument?
Yes, Your Honor. My name is Christopher Wynn. It may please the court. Christopher Wynn, NGUYEN, on behalf of Adrian Medina, the minor youth. Your Honor, with regard to our appeal, we appeal essentially on two grounds. One is the factual findings of the court with regard to Mr. Medina's young Mr. Medina's whether or not the facts of the findings of the court actually met the criteria as laid out by the statute. And the second issue that we're addressing is in direct confrontation with the State v. Bail case. It is the State v. Bail case that I think presents the stronger argument and that I'm hopeful that this court is willing to entertain.
Right. Counsel, before you move to the constitutional argument, I just want to clarify your introduction of the other issue. You at first seemed to indicate that you were challenging one or more of the district court's factual findings, but then seemed to indicate that you weren't challenging factual findings, you were just challenging the district court's decision having applied the law and the criteria to those findings. So could you just clarify, are you challenging any of the historical facts found by the court?
The short answer to that is yes, Your Honor. I think that the way in which the court ruled on a couple of the factors are not necessarily consistent with what.
Well, Mr. Wynn, there's a difference between deciding that a factor weighs in favor or against, say, certification, and the underlying finding of fact. So we have facts and factors. So I don't know which it is. It seemed to me that the bulk of the argument was not contesting underlying findings of fact, but rather the decision, the discretionary decision, the exercise of discretion in deciding whether that those findings supported or weighed how those findings, affect the weighing of a factor.
Sure. So thank you, Justice. With regard to the factual findings, one of the concerns that I had in particular in the certification hearing was the court's finding that there were no mitigating circumstances whatsoever. And and in particular, what I can tell you is even based on the contents of the complaint and what I think this court is readily able to use in both the record and what is common knowledge is that we have a couple of youths. In fact, there were three youths that were alleged to have been going around and breaking into cars, grabbing change, cigarettes, and the like. They were approached by a couple of 20-year-old men. These men did not decide to contact law enforcement. These men did not notify authorities. Instead, what they did is they approached the youth. And what we have in the psychologist and her testimony, it was never presented to her in such a way. This psychologist was not one that was provided by the defense. It was in fact provided by Mr. Baker's office. And there, I could not imagine even a 20-year-old man that would turn around and approach a youth that thought that they were breaking into their car and was like, "Hey, could you stop? Could you please stop?" Right? And the mere fact that we have, I
Why
think,
not? That we hear about that every day in the news. People see somebody out by their car and say, "Hey, you, what are you doing?" Regrettably, there are often tragic consequences, but that's not an unheard of factual scenario.
sure. And instead, what we have within the contents of the complaint, Your Honor, in addressing that is that we have confrontation between the alleged victims in the case and my client and a couple of co-defendants.
So, what are the facts that the district court found regarding that encounter or confrontation, to use your word, that you think were clearly erroneous?
So what I think is clearly erroneous is that there was no threat that was ever presented to my client. And at the point in time where the alleged victim says, "You better shoot me," in suggesting that one of the defendants had presented or brandished a firearm, in doing so, it begs the question, or what? And when you have a minor youth that isn't presented with
So are you saying that the threat is, in this case, the findings of the district court were clearly erroneous because the district court did not find that the victim threatened the defendant?
That is the juvenile
in this case.
Yes. To put it bluntly, and whether or not there was a direct threat that was made, such as "I will do this," we're talking about somebody who was barely 16.
Is there any error in what the district court says those 20-year-old men did or said?
There is not. The court does not deny the contents of the complaint nor the reports that are there. But what the court does find is that there are not any mitigating factors. And when a 16-year-old boy is confronted with a 20-year-old male, I think that the testimony and the transcripts readily provide what that confrontation looked like and how we would expect an inexperienced child to respond to the confrontation of a grown man.
Well, the problem I had with that argument is you seem to be suggesting it's some sort of self-defense situation. And self-defense requires, of course, that the person who's making the claim was not the person who initially instigated the confrontation, was not the initial aggressor. I mean, your client was suspected of breaking into a car. Doesn't that sort of initiate the confrontation? Does he get to claim self-defense? I mean, he could have, you know, turned around and walked away, and instead he pulls out a gun. I mean, it seems a bit of a stretch.
That's your honor, completely fair. At the point in time where where my client is alleged to have gone into the car, certainly somebody saying, "Hey, get out of my car," is one thing. That isn't what happened. What happened was, "Hey, come over here." And it's that kind of confrontation where they are summoned over by an adult, where the confrontation is vastly different. It is vastly different.
Counsel, because your time is limited, I just want to focus you in a little bit. I completely understand what the arguments would be in this case from the defense perspective in favor of EJJ treatment versus certification. But we can't substitute our judgment for that of the district court. This isn't reviewed de novo. In order to prevail on the non-constitutional arguments, you have to show that the district court somehow abused its discretion in a way that was not harmless. And you've articulated one theory about the failure to recognize mitigating circumstances. Are there other errors you would assign before moving to your constitutional argument that we should consider when assessing whether or not the district court abused its discretion?
Your Honor, that is the primary one. The only other thing that I would really note for the court is that what I would say is the temperament of the order really seems to place young Mr. Medina in a position where he's being treated like an adult. Your Honor, at the district level, I'll tell you that it is fairly uncommon to see a lot of private practice attorneys. The vast majority of the cases that I've seen are commonly addressed by public defenders. And there is such a wide degree of variability in how every county is treating children, from carjackings that have been very prevalent over the last couple of years and during the COVID time, to this. And it is the lack of consistency that I see that really brought about what I felt was the need for the change in this particular instance.
Interesting.
So, you said the temperament of the order. Is there some standard that we would apply to the the sort of tone of a district court order that we could say that based on its tone, it is an abuse of discretion?
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't necessarily be the tone itself. But what I would say is that it would be my hope that the court system would make a concerted effort to apply the law where we don't see Mr. Medina as somebody that has this escalating issue or history of violence, things that would absolutely comport and with the law with regard to his criminal history.
I mean, that seems to be different than the tone. It seems now you're getting into whether the public safety factors actually are the right things to consider. That seems to be a different issue, that more of a policy issue than what's wrong with the tone of the court's order. And if there's something wrong with it, what's our standard that we use to determine if that tone is somehow, a basis to reverse?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't suggest that the tone is a basis to reverse, nor would I argue on the legislature's ability to write the public safety factors the way in which they have.
Counsel, let me interrupt you because you did say something that's very interesting to me. And what you seem to be saying is similarly situated juveniles who are facing certification should be treated the same across the state. And you've raised a concern that that's not happening. And yet, we have the sentencing guidelines to ensure that we treat similarly situated people the same across the state. Why would we treat juveniles differently? Is there any case law talking about that? I mean, does this court have the ability to say, well, we're familiar with certification decisions across the state, and this one looks perhaps out of line to us, and therefore that's a concern? It's a very interesting point you've made.
Your Honor, I wish I would have had the resources to provide the court with that kind of information. And unfortunately, that is not a part of the argument, nor is it an argument that I'm prepared to make today.
I'm pretty sure there's no case that discusses this, but you do raise an interesting point.
With regard to, if I may move on to the constitutional issue.
I mean, if I can, I just want to clarify. It seems like the argument that this decision is somehow out of the norm or is an aberration when you look at statewide and you would want to compare it to some statistics or data that you don't have, that seems to be an argument purely about abuse of discretion and not so much an argument about the Equal Protection Clause of the constitutional aspect. Is that right? That's a separate and apart from your Equal Protection Clause argument.
That is correct. The other portion that and the constitutional portion that I look at and the argument that I make here is really about the State v. Bail case. And State v. Bail recognizes that children do not have a constitutional right to juvenile adjudication. The court file number is going to be 564 Northwest 2D 560. And my argument is in direct confrontation with that. While children do not have a fundamental right to juvenile adjudication, what they do have a fundamental right to is to vote. We now have a child that is charged with a felony, and if he were to be convicted of a felony, his right to vote will be impaired.
Counsel, the question I have about that argument is, let's face it, the best you're going to do here is EJJ. You're not getting delinquency adjudication for a 16-year-old that fired 5 shots at 2 people at close range. Thankfully, no one was hurt. It's my understanding that if he were to get EJJ treatment and there were a state adult sentence, and he were to get revoked, well, then he's going to be in the same position as an adult that received a felony sentence. In other words, the law treats an EJJ conviction the same as an adult felony. So wouldn't these concerns about voting, right to travel, et cetera, exist if he had won and came out with EJJ treatment rather than certification?
You know, I I admit that's possible. That's absolutely possible, Your Honor. However,
so then why does the right to vote argument make a difference in this case? Because it seems to me the only way it would make a difference is if you were saying, well, if he weren't certified, weren't EJJ, there would be a delinquency adjudication. He wouldn't lose any of these other rights. He's going to as a result of a felony conviction. But a delinquency adjudication is not within the realm of possibility in this case. So that's why I have a problem with your constitutional argument.
You know, Your Honor, while delinquency adjudication is highly unlikely in the matter, I wouldn't necessarily concede that in its entirety. With that being said,
well, then you'd have to be a super lawyer.
You know, occasionally, Your Honor, the stars align.
Yeah.
If I may, Judge Larkin, I know time has expired. Mr. Nguyen, you acknowledge that you're asking us to essentially overrule State v. Bail. That's a Minnesota Supreme Court case. What is your basis for asking this court or this panel to do that?
The simple and straightforward basis, Your Honor, is as simple as this. If you have a juvenile that is...
No, I don't mean like, what is your argument? I mean, I don't believe this panel can overrule a Minnesota Supreme Court case. I don't think we have that authority.
No, I would concede that, Your Honor, but I also don't think the case where procedurally I would anticipate the Supreme Court taking a direct appeal.
All right, you'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Thank you for answering our questions. We'll now hear from counsel for the state. Sir, would you introduce yourself before you begin your argument?
Thank you. This is Shane Baker, Candiac County Attorney for the state. The last conversation is actually a great segue to how I had my notes. I kind of summarized how I saw the issues here as first the juvenile is asking this court to change the law, whether it's the constitutional provisions that have been addressed by the Supreme Court in Bail, Mitchell, and Grisby. That's its request here. Or whether it's treating age as a suspect class within its arguments. These are all requests of the Court of Appeals to change Supreme Court law, which it's not able to do, but I understand that.
Maybe I misread it, but I thought the primary argument was under a rational basis standard, right?
Well, I think that was primary. It was just still some language in the brief though. Or the second kind of theme I think plays here is that the appellant's claiming juvenile jurisdiction is somehow rested in the consequences that come with an adult sentence, which I think on the constitutional issues is looking at it backwards. I'll first start with the court's decision. We submit it's not an abuse of discretion. There are a number of factors, or six. This district court relied on one of the two primary that's listed in the statute, the severity of the offense, the seriousness of the offense. That's stated in the statute. And within the court's order, it's the only factor that it said strongly and clearly. All the other factors that either said favors certification, does not favor certification, but the seriousness was strongly and clear. I think that emphasizes the district court's emphasis on that factor.
What is the second factor that's supposed to receive the most emphasis in a certification decision?
Prior delinquency history.
All right, and he has none. Well, that's he has correct. No, okay. That's so the two most important factors are seriousness of the offense, culpability, and he loses those, but he doesn't have a delinquency history. He has some truancy, stays of adjudication for minor offenses. I think fleeing police on foot, I mean, no felony level offense. No indication that he has been under the supervision of the juvenile court in a way that required him to go to treatment, placed out of home, chemical dependency, any of that in his history?
No.
Okay. And so several of the factors could favor an EJJ disposition, and the district court recognized that, yes?
I saw that they only used one to favor the EJJ status.
And which factor was that?
That was the prior delinquency history.
Okay, so he doesn't have prior history. Well, then what were the historical facts found regarding the level of programming available to him were he to be retained in the juvenile court?
Well, the court considered the lack of participation in the mental health therapy to be significant.
And what was that mental health therapy? Was it court ordered as part of his probation?
Yes.
Okay. And what does the record tell us about his unwillingness to participate in that?
Well, I believe the records indicate that he did not fully participate in that therapy.
Was there a record made by his counsel, perhaps, of potential placements that would be available to him if he were retained in the juvenile system on EJJ status? For example, placement at Minnesota Department of Corrections Red Wing program.
Yeah, there was discussion of the alternatives. I believe it was the probation agent who discussed how, for example, the local facility would not want to take him because of the flight risk.
Okay, well, I assume that, but what about something like locked Red Wing? Did the district court consider and reject that as an available option?
Let's see. I know they certainly reviewed all each and every factor, disagreed with, because the doctor who did the evaluation gave greater credence to that there'd be dispositional options such as that available.
Okay. And the doctor who did the evaluation said there were factors for and against certification and didn't render an opinion regarding what would be the outcome most consistent with public safety. Is that correct?
I thought she weighed it in favor of keeping it EJJ.
Oh.
But I know that in her assessment, her standard, she indicated programming history is one of the two primary factors, and that's legally wrong. It's prior delinquency history and the seriousness.
Okay. But programming history is a significant factor when you're talking about whether, because this is a presumptive commitment offense, right? So it's we're really talking about if he gets convicted, should he go to prison at age 16 for what he did?
Correct.
Okay. And that there has been sort of a change in judicial philosophy that recognizes that kids this age, even kids a little bit older, most oftentimes don't know what they're doing and don't make good decisions. And that sort of should factor into an assessment of, you know, is there any chance of giving the youth services to change their behavior and instead of sending him or her to prison? Did you feel like the district court really considered that in deciding this case?
No, I believe they did. I mean, they looked at the number of issues from the therapy to the Prairie Lakes programming and not participating to his own comments about manipulating weak-minded people, looking at the programming options such as Northwest Minnesota Juvenile Center. Yeah, I see Red Wing listed, Prairie Lakes.
Wasn't the trial court also concerned with the time, that there wasn't much time to do juvenile programming, and that weighed in favor of the adult certification?
Yes, I believe that they were concerned about that, or the judge was. I think the judge did look at all the factors. Wade made comment on them, but really came down on the nature and seriousness of the crime as the one that weighed most heavily in this. And I think it's at least not an abuse of discretion. We can argue about how juveniles should be treated in the system, whether these are the right factors, what are the weight given them, but those are policy decisions for the legislature, for example. The court considered it. It wasn't a knee jerk. This is a second degree attempted murder case, therefore it's cert. It looked at the severity. It looked at the manner in which the crime was committed, the location where it was committed, the doctor's comments about effect on the victim in making that decision.
I have to admit that over the years, I've always been concerned about these cases where timing is one of the claimed necessity items for adult certification. And then there's an appeal assuring that there's going to be less time to be in juvenile court when it's all over. I'm not sure what to do about that, but it's really a peculiar situation.
No, that is definitely true.
And does the record indicate, had he been sent to a program like Minnesota Correctional Facility, Red Wing, how long could he stay in that program? Is it till age 19 or beyond that? Or is it only 18? Is that sort of information fleshed out in the record? And of course, recognizing as the district court did, you know, even EJJ, we have a jury trial. It'll take time to resolve that. So that cuts into the time. But I would think if you're analyzing the availability of appropriate resources in the juvenile system that would protect public safety and Commissioner of Corrections, I can't imagine one that would better protect public safety, at least while he's detained. Wouldn't we want to know, well, how long could he be there? What would they work on? Can he be there till 18, till 19, till 21? Wouldn't that factor into the decision? Because if we're till 21, that's, you know, 5 years at the Commissioner of Corrections.
Right.
Certainly a good amount of time.
Well, I know the record certainly talked about the length of jurisdiction under EJJ, which, because that's where the comparison.
Which is 21, right?
Right, that's 21.
Right. So, I mean, that's a decent amount of time. Not as long as there would be for adult probation, obviously. So then I guess the question I have is, okay, within that 5 years, how long could he be in a secure facility to really assess whether he could make changes that would allow him to be back in the public? Or is he so bad that he needs to go to prison?
Right. And my understanding has always been they do have authority through age 21.
At Red Wing?
At Red Wing.
Oh.
I see my time's limited, so I'll move on to the constitutional issues. I mentioned before about how looking at from what's the punishment's going to be to affect whether there's a right to a juvenile adjudication. And that does not seem to be how the Supreme Court has analyzed the issue. They first looked at where does authority vest in the court for handling cases. Constitution says it's vested in district court and other such courts as the legislature sets up. And then the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, the legislature sets the parameter of what's in the juvenile court. That's B.L. Grisby and Mitchell. And then they make commentary that the right to a juvenile adjudication exists only if the legislature makes it exclusive. So unless you have an exclusive right to juvenile jurisdiction, you don't have this right to a juvenile adjudication. Otherwise, it's the legislature that sets the parameters. And for procedural due process issues, there's no specific procedures required. You have notice and opportunity to be heard, but you don't have a specific procedure such as the burdens on the state. And here the issue from the appellant is that the presumption lies with certification as opposed to the state proving it should be certified. I do note that bail actually was an automatic certification case, which didn't allow a juvenile there to have a chance to say this should stay in juvenile court. So my position is, how is that constitutional yet a procedure that allows for a juvenile to have his day in court, argue that it should be kept as a juvenile, would be unconstitutional. For substantive due process, as long as the system is not arbitrary or capricious and sets a reasonable means to a permitted objective, the process is due. And here we have a quite the spectrum of how the legislature has set things up. level of crime, nature of the felony, presumptive commission or firearm use or a prior creates the cert, presumed certification situation, or your lower level felonies, non-presumptive situation, and the age of the child. 14 and 15 year olds are treated different than 15 and 16 or 16 and 17 year olds.
Let me ask you about that because an interesting point was raised in appellant's argument. I mean, what do you think of this situation we have where an adult must be treated similarly to similarly situated adults under the guidelines? But when determining whether a minor should be certified for prosecution as an adult on anything other than first degree murder, it's really up to the judge with a huge amount of discretion. Does that seem inconsistent when the end result of that is placement in a situation where you are going to be treated the same as similarly situated offenders? Should we be applying the sentencing guidelines principles to certification decisions?
Well, that is interesting, but it kind of begs the question of where is it the lack of treating these cases as severely as they should be?
Mm-hmm.
Or the other way, which is there's very few treating them as within they the presumed. Be. Right. Okay. But it's also.
See, but I think that begs the question because, and I honestly, I was a judge in a rural county. So I understand that there's a significant difference. And I was a public defender in Hennepin County. And I'm not saying who's right or who's wrong. Probably if you ask defense attorneys, they would tell you I'm not soft on crime. And you might think I would go more the way of the rural counties. But it does strike me as a little bit unfair that there is nothing in place to ensure that similarly situated juveniles are treated similarly when it comes to certification. So, you know, in Hennepin County, I don't know that this would be certified, but I can certainly understand why it was certified in Candiohi County. But that circumstance is exactly what's driven the sentencing guidelines. It's also what's driven the legislature to change limits on probation terms. So people across the street have similar probation lengths. So is it so odd to suggest that, well, maybe that principle should apply to certification decisions as well?
No, it's not, but I don't think it changes the dynamic here because even on adults and using the sentencing guidelines, there's what each individual judge considers substantial and compelling is varies across the board.
Right, but that's for a departure, not for the presumed decision.
But then you run into even what's pled to, whether it's a presumptive commit or not. And
I understand this is well beyond the briefing. I wasn't expecting that thought to be raised. And it does cause me to wonder whether that concept has any application when assessing whether a judge abused discretion. Because, for example, if we're looking at a sentence and we give tremendous discretion to a judge in imposing sentence, and somebody is saying, well, this sentence is out of line, what they generally do is like bring other cases in, look at how these cases have been sentenced, and we as a bench can rely on our collective knowledge to determine whether or not the sentence was out of line. Can we as a bench rely on our collective knowledge to determine whether certification is out of line in a close case?
Well, I haven't seen that come up as an issue before.
Okay. And I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No.
It's just a conversation.
Yeah, no, it's interesting how the data would yield too, because on the adult sentencing, it's interesting that some crimes have, let's say, a 50% departure rate, then that begs the question.
Downwards.
Downward. So how's that downward, substantial and compelling reasons?
Right. Understood. All right. I've taken us far off track. Do you want to sum up your argument in light of all the time I've taken?
I guess that's why I used those kind of headings where it was, where you look at, the constitutional issues trying to say that there's this right to a juvenile adjudication because of the impact it could have, where you look at where the authority and the jurisdiction, is created from and analyze the issue that way. And to have a structure in place where the legislature considers 14, 15-year-olds, it should be tougher to get to a certification than for a 16-year-old and 17-year-old. That seems rationally related to the goal. Or you have, say, property crimes. It's harder to get to presumptive to a certification as adult versus a violent crime like second-degree assault or attempted murder. That those seem rational structure set up, which would then withstand substantial due process and equal protection claims.
And at the end of the day, do you think we can reverse, say, a Supreme Court opinion?
No, I think it's the route to get to the Supreme Court for AM.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments. We'll now have a rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. The as a rebuttal to the state's argument, I one of the things that I would point out is with regard to some of the sentencing options that would have been available to the court, given the attempt modifier, and this was contained in my district court briefing, we're really talking about a difference of 6 months were he to have been sentenced at his hearing date, were his case to have resolved at the time of his certification hearing. And so given that.
Just for my benefit and everybody else, what is the presumptive sentence with an attempt modifier with zero criminal history?
Your Honor, I think the bottom of the box is, I think is 60 months.
What's the center of the box?
I apologize. I don't have that in front of me. I believe
okay. Isn't it, if it's 60 to 90 and if it's attempt to tap, right?
Yeah, that is correct, Your Honor.
So we're talking, even at the top end of the box, 45 months, multiple victims, so they could be concurrent. So 90 months. All right.
And so given that kind
of. So about 7 years.
Yes, Your Honor, not including the super time for supervised release, et cetera, but given the time in custody and given that an EJJ jurisdiction would have held Mr. Medina until his 21st, we'd be looking at, I had calculated about a difference of 6 months were it to have been a bottom of the box case. Also, with regard to the statute, Your Honor, one of the elements of the statute is the dispositional options that are available to the child. Now, I sit on the Corrections Advisory Board for Ramsey County, and we don't have a suitable facility. In fact, in the state of Minnesota, I think we only have 4 facilities that are properly able to take up youth. I believe that the approximate capacity of all of these facilities combined is about 250 beds.
And what are the 4 facilities? Red Wing, I assume, is one.
That is correct, Your Honor. Red Wing is one of them. Prairie Lakes Youth Programming is the other.
And is that a long-term program?
I don't know that Prairie Lakes is considered a long-term program. The Your Honor, give me just a moment. I can absolutely get the other two.
No, that's not necessary. That's not
so.
Is it fair to say we're at a point where Red Wing is the only secure long-term programming option for serious juvenile offenders in the state?
That is, in my esteem, 100% accurate, Your Honor.
And what board do you sit on?
The Corrections Advisory Board for Ramsey.
Corrections
County.
Advisory Board. So then, do you know if will Red Wing take a minor who's been certified, or will Red Wing only take a minor if they've not?
It is my understanding they only take minors who have not been certified.
Okay, so that's not available as a result of certification.
No, Your Honor. And in fact, with regard to, I apologize, I don't recall who asked the question. Where timing was an issue, we did ask that Mr. Medina be allowed to remain in Prairie Lakes youth care during the course and pending his appeal, and that request was denied by the judge.
Is he in adult jail now?
He is in an adult jail now for the vast majority of his time. He has been isolated, as there are no other youths who have been certified. My wife and I had brought him books, and the jail would not allow him to receive those books until a rookie deputy decided to bring them to him. And so he was not receiving the care. He was a part of a CHIPS case prior to this. The where he does not have the ability to vote, he doesn't have the ability to participate in any of the dispositional options that are available to him. For him to then have to be the one to bear the burden of proving that his disposition has to serve public interest, I think is an unconstitutional shift in the burden.
But here's the thing. The burden is what the burden is. At the end of the day, the judge has to make a decision, with public safety being at the forefront, whether there is perhaps a way to fix this kid, and he deserves fixing. I mean, a record's created. I don't know that it's a situation where the judge was thinking, well, if he didn't have the burden, I'd rule for him. I mean, it really comes down to what the record shows. So I'm not as put off by who has the burden. What concerns me is this: when you talk about the number of treatment programs that are left in this state for serious juvenile offenders, you know, on one hand, we have a push to say, well, we're not going to detain kids, we don't want to treat them like criminals, on and on. Yet, so we close down all these programs that are secure and long-term. And then when we do have a juvenile who does something completely unacceptable and puts the public at risk, we really don't have a choice but to certify him or her because we've closed down all the programs.
That is absolutely the factor.
It seems like the people that are trying to help the kids are really their worst enemy.
It is a matter of fiscal priority.
Understood.
I have nothing further for the court to consider.
All right. Well, we thank you for your arguments and for your briefing. The matter is submitted. We'll issue a decision in a timely fashion.
Thank you.
That concludes the court's Zoom hearings this morning. We will now go to our deliberations. Thank you.